Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Private Eye Podcast. I'm Helen Lewis, sitting in for Andy in the chair this week, and joining me are Jane McKenzie, Ian Hislop and Adam McQueen. This week, we're going to kick off with Gorgeous George, George Galloway, the newly minted MP for Rochdale. I have to say that I greeted his return with a kind of groan of, oh no, back again. But then I sort of remembered that he's got an enormously large greatest hits sort of back catalogue in. Can you remember when he first kind of crossed your consciousness?
Well, it was so long ago. I think he was a member of the Labour Party. Obviously, I'm going way back here. But that was before various permutations in which he was always on the border of being sacked by the Labour Party, or there was always some reason successive Labour leaders wanted to get rid of him or found him incredibly embarrassing. And then he moved, and it was Respect, I think it was next after that, and then it was the Workers' Party.
There was Respect, and then Respect split, as kind of sects on the left tend to do, and then there was a sort of offshoot of Respect, which was basically just George, and then I think he fell out with himself as well, and that was the end of that. And now, yes, it's the Workers' Party, not the Workers' Revolutionary Party, they were different, but the Workers' Party.
There are a lot of marriages along the way, almost as many marriages as political parties, but there have been periods where George Galloway's, not only his marital life, but his sex life became massive news. I mean, George went on a charitable mission to Mykonos and admitted that he had a huge amount of heterosexual sex with people on Mykonos. And I thought, well, that's amazing. That really is a first.
So my tiny quiz for this week is, can you name one of the constituencies he has previously represented? There are four previous ones before Rochdale.
Bradford.
Bradford West, yep.
When he got in, he said, this is the Bradford Spring.
Like the Arab Spring, yes, I remember that.
I mean, he does repeat a bit. So this time when he won, he said, this is for Gaza. And I remember him saying, this is for Iraq. So he does win on behalf of major trouble zones in the world.
You look like you knew one, Adam.
Bethnal Green.
Bethnal Green and Bow, correct.
Yep.
Yes, exactly.
Can I go for the boat? Can I go for the first one?
This is almost like a pointless answer now. If you can get the first one, I will
Glasgow,
give you a...
Glasgow Hillhead.
Hillhead. From Roy Jenkins.
Very good.
Who was the former MP there.
Can you name... That was Glasgow Hillhead between 1987 and 1997. Can you name the subsequent Glasgow constituency that he's then stood for?
No.
No. That's going to be amazing because that was Kelvin, Glasgow Kelvin.
Kelvin.
I would say my first contact with George Galloway was, I think, probably actually when he had that big ding-dong with Christopher Hitchens and called him a drink-sodden former Trotskyist popinjay. And I can't remember what Christopher Hitchens said back. I imagine it was similarly uncomplimentary. But that was around the time of the Iraq War. And one of the things that's often mentioned up is, what did he say to Saddam? I salute your courage.
I salute your courage, your strength, your indefatigability.
I can't pronounce that word.
It's the only time anyone's ever said indefatigability.
I can see why.
That's described George incredibly well.
Perfect,
he is indefatigable.
Ian, has he ever sued you?
No, he's often very disappointed by Private Eye. He feels we've let down the side, and I'm never sure which side that is, because I'm not very keen on sides. But
I think you can usually trust that it's the side of George Galloway, can't you, in most issues concerning him.
And right the way through, I mean, there was a period where, I mean, George Galloway was the most litigious person in Britain, and he just won. I remember we used to try and top up in our heads his income over the course of any year out of newspapers. And it was sort of quite funny. And everyone just rolled over because the idea of taking on Galloway or paying up in the days when libel was just mad and a complete lottery, people just paid up.
He had the big case, didn't he, in the sort of early noughties when the Telegraph and the Christian Science Monitor, I think, an American newspaper that's actually more respectable than its title makes it sound, accused him of taking bribes from the Iraqi government in the form of oil barrels. And it was, unfortunately, complete nonsense. It was based on forged documents that had been sort of conveniently
found
left
in
somewhere.
The ruins. Yeah. So it was a story that journalists were so excited about. You know, we're wandering through the ruins of Saddam's palace, and look, here's a piece of paper on it which says, "Pay George Galloway the following huge sum." So, and rather than thinking, "Oh, there, wouldn't it be nice if that were true?" they said, "This is true, must be." And got into terrible, terrible financial trouble.
No, he had a great victory with that one. He was a bit less lucky with some of his legal travails later on. There was a point where he was accused of anti-Semitism by several people on Twitter, and he employed a legal firm called Chambers Bradford. This is during this is post Bradford Spring. This is sort of Bradford summer, autumn kind of time. They decided to send out letters before action, but not the usual sort of letters before action that you've probably had a few of, Ian. These ones said, pay us $6,000 up front and we'll make this go away, which it was then pointed out very rapidly to the Solicitors Regulation Authority. It's not really the way the law works. And so there was a big investigation into Chambers Bradford, not only on that topic, but also the fact that they were at that point undergoing a criminal investigation, which ended up with two of their partners being convicted of fraud and struck off as solicitors. So that probably wasn't George's most glorious moment with the legal profession. Last heard of with KRW Law in Northern Ireland, I think, who are about the fiercest firm of solicitors this side of Carter Ruck.
I mean, I say he tended to win against newspapers. I mean, when his former assistant decided to enter into prolonged litigation with George Gurley, that didn't go so well. Also, when he had a by-election campaign in which he accused his opponent of being a very bad Muslim and of having faked the fact that she was put into an arranged marriage.
That was Naz Shah, who, and he said she wasn't 15, she was 16 when this happened, which he said really went to the heart of her credibility. Whereas the
entirely different matter, being put into a forced marriage at the age of 16 rather than 15, isn't it? Yes, yeah.
Jane, on a lighter note, what animal did George Galloway impersonate once on Celebrity Big Brother?
Oh, wow. That was a moment. His buzzy cat.
Oh, I can't believe... Oh, why?
Do you want me to be the cat?
No, he defended himself at the time, saying this is no less than people did on other shows, and it wasn't worse than that, and it got the message across.
He came out of it absolutely. I mean, to be fair, he played it entirely to his advantage, because he then made his theme tune for his talk show the Top Cat theme. You know, he was absolutely unashamed and unembarrassed by it. That would be the talk show that he presented, I think, on both Russia Today and Press TV.
Sputnik, funded by
the Sputnik was the spin-off from Russia Today, wasn't it? Just a very old-fashioned notion, but we did used to have a problem with public servants being in the pay of foreign governments, didn't we? Wasn't that a thing back
now,
in
I
the day
like
that
say
was
on
generally frowned on?
Behalf of KRW Law of Northern Ireland, that George Galloway threatened to sue Twitter for branding him as Russian state-affiliated media for hosting the mother of all talk shows on Sputnik, and he says he's never received any money from a foreign government. He's only received it from Sputnik.
Again, his record on, say, sexual misdemeanours in Iran is not strong. He now describes himself as socially conservative, which goes down extremely well with Muslim voters who think they know what that means. But for a lot of other people...
including several ex-wives.
Quite. This is now a conservative position.
And Adam, I can see that this is a time you kind of expect George Galloway to come back, because I think the backlash to Israel's incursion into Gaza after October the 7th has really generated a lot of anti-Israeli government sentiment that sometimes tips over into anti-Israel, anti-Semitic statements. And that does seem to be, anti-Israel has been a kind of motif of George Galloway's career, hasn't it?
Oh, it absolutely has. I mean, famously, when he was MP for Bradford, he declared the entire city an Israeli-free zone, which is a fairly inflammatory statement, whichever way you cut it. I mean,
apart from it wasn't just investment and business opportunities. He said, we don't want Israeli tourists here. It was absolutely specific, and you can see why at the time people thought, is that tipping over into the sort of apartheid he's very keen to accuse Israel of propagating?
And famously, he refuses to debate in any kind of political debates with anyone with Israeli citizenship. So, I mean, the idea that this is going to in any way going to be sort of, you know, working towards a two-state solution or any kind of diplomatic end to this conflict, as if the MP for Rochdale has any sort of actual sway over over international affairs anyway. I mean, it ain't going to happen.
He's been around for so long in British politics that actually he once refused to debate a student about 10, 15 years ago, and that student is now Israel's spokesman.
Really?
Levy. Yeah.
I did not know the second half of that story. Okay, that's what I was referring to.
Yeah, he's,
right.
He's an official Israeli spokesman now. That's how the wheel has turned. That God, a whole generation...
Possibly inspired by being rejected by George Galloway. He thought, right, I'm going full on. Wow.
Spin doctor, exactly, yeah.
I mean, it's really interesting when Ian brought up the aspect of LGBT rights, because I remember when there was the famous case, I mean, a kind of poster case for an awful lot of these cases, but with the two Iranian teenage boys who were hanged for the crime of sodomy, as it's called over there, and George Galloway was quite happy to defend this and say that actually, you know, they were convicted of sex crimes. And well, that is kind of the point, is that the Iranian state criminalizes sexual activities between men, you know.
But what he said was that this was just typical of the sort of issue that people use to try and discredit the Iranian government. And that is always George Galloway's line, is that whenever things are inconvenient about the people he supports, he turns it back and says, well, that is what you would say. So if people say, well, what happened with the various charities you were involved with and the trouble about oil and, you know, the various things during the Iraq War, he says, well, what about Halliburton? What about America's record? What about neo-imperialism from you lot? And he's good at that. I mean, whataboutery is George Galloway's forte. And there's always someone who, in a George tirade, at some point he'll say something you agree with. And that's really awful. And he'll get you that way.
Right, and I remember that in terms of the Iraq War, and you mentioned Halliburton there, you know, which was the company linked to Dick Cheney that did make an enormous amount of money out of the reconstruction. And that was a fair point, that there was a very unnuanced critique that it was a war for oil, it was a war just purely for American interests. I'm not sure that's entirely true, but it is also a fact that lots of military contractors got extremely rich out of that war in a way that seems really quite tasteless in retrospect.
I was just saying, it's not just whataboutery either. I mean, it tips over into straightforward denial of facts. I mean, the last time I found myself writing about George Galloway was back in 2018 and 2019, when he was subject to all sorts of Ofcom complaints against both Russia Today, I think it rebranded itself as RT.com by that point, and Talk Radio, amazingly, Rupert Murdoch's Talk Radio, which he used to present a show on as well. But essentially, those were a number of complaints about him running shows where he basically just denied that there was any Russian involvement in the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter in Salisbury. Just sort of flat out, no, it couldn't have been the Russians, because, you know, they're his team, essentially.
And he said the Tucker Carlson interview was great with Putin, and everyone should watch it, and it would banish your preconceptions. whatever preconceptions one might have about Putin, I don't know.
To be fair, it did banish my preconceptions, that Tucker Carlson interview with Putin, because I thought Putin would be a bit more interesting, whereas he just gave him a sort of hour-long lecture on the history of Russia from about 1300 to the present. So, in a way, well done, Vladimir Putin. But yes, and Tucker Carlson didn't ask about Alexei Navalny, for example, in that interview, who was then imprisoned and obviously is now dead. And it's not to me the most stirring piece of penetrative broadcast journalism I've ever seen. But George,
it's enough for George.
It's enough for George. And also, you know, his supporters surrounded Sky News' Sam Coates at them, and when he's questioning on the count, and you can see him doing what is now a very popular move of, you're the establishment media. And then obviously that kind of makes people think, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? You know, any criticism of George Galloway can be dismissed because that's just the establishment kicking back against him.
But he worked for the Iranian establishment and the Russian establishment.
The last place he popped up was Beijing last year, appearing at the second International Forum on Democracy. And praising the Chinese regime all over state-controlled media over there. I mean, there's not many kind of really unpleasant regimes out there that George isn't willing to do a bit of burnishing the reputations of.
I think that's one of the things that's really interesting to me about his re-emergence, is what exactly his politics are. Because he's classically described as being part of the kind of hard left or far left. But actually, as you say, there's a real soup of different types of politics there. He made a very big appeal, as you say, to Muslim voters, particularly in Rochdale. You know, he starts with Salam Aleikum, and he talks about the Ummah, you know, the global Muslim community. So he's very embedded in that kind of sectarian politics, I guess you would say, that is often quite unpleasant. But as you say, the other motif throughout his career is defending men accused of sexual offences. He was a big defender of Julian Assange. He's been recently defending Russell Brand, saying that, you know, the only reason he's being pursued is because he spoke up against the COVID lockdowns. So there is a kind of worldview there that it feels to me like a pick and mix from lots and lots of anti-establishment issues. But I wouldn't now describe it as actually either left or right wing. It is sort of anti-establishment, isn't it? It's that kind of conspiracy sort of soup he's drawn from.
Well, this is kind of a return to his greatest hits, this latest election victory, because the election before this that I can remember from was the 2019 general election, when he stood in West Bromwich East, that bizarrely named constituency, against Tom Watson, at that point deputy leader of Labour. And that was on a pro-Brexit ticket. Do you remember George hanging around on a podium with Nigel Farage? There's a particularly alarming, you've wiped it from your memory, there is a particularly alarming photo of the pair of them grinning like Cheshire cats together.
But and the exact wording he used to Farage was, "I salute your..." was it?
Your courage, your strength. I can say it. Indefatigability.
Very good. Yes. In that election, I'd just like to point out, he picked up a total of 489 votes, which may be why he's decided to return to the greatest hits at this point. Mayor of London, do you remember that, 2016?
No.
Stood for Mayor of London. Didn't turn up at the count because he knew he wasn't going to win it, and so just didn't turn up. Less than 2% of the vote in that one. So he knows, he's worked out now where his audience is and where he can bag the votes. Well, the really interesting thing is not the number of elections that George Galloway has won, it's the number of re-elections he hasn't won. And certainly these have tended to be sort of one-term things, and then whichever community has got fully behind him finds that maybe he isn't all that they expected, and the off he goes at the next election.
The people of Rochdale probably don't have to put up with him for long if they decide they've made a terrible error now.
Well, I think what's interesting is it's very hard to extrapolate from that by-election, because there are a lot of moving parts that you won't find necessarily elsewhere in the country. So you have an independent coming second who is a local garage owner who seems to be, you know, very invested in the local community in a way that perhaps George Galloway isn't. You have a Labour candidate who is, you know, basically accused of anti-Semitism, and Labour pull their support, so there's no Labour campaigning.
No Labour candidate,
the Conservatives come absolutely nowhere. And then Reform, who you might expect in other constituencies to pick up a bit more of that anti-establishment vote, their candidate is Simon Danchuk, who used to be the Labour MP there and was not particularly well-liked, left in, you know, not particularly great circumstances. So it was a kind of, it was in sort of an open goal, I think, to some extent, for George Galloway, that constituency, which it won't necessarily be repeated at the general election.
How many other people are there? And I hate to sound as though I'm giving him any respect, which was another political party he ran briefly for a while. Why is it that he can mobilise that level of support? I mean, because, you know, we have a go at the Conservative Party when they come out and say, well, it wasn't a great result when they got three votes. When he comes out, everyone goes, well, it's not such a big deal. I mean, you know, it's only 40% of the vote. Anyone could do that. And the depressing thing is anyone can't.
No, and I would say, you're right. For him, it was a very huge swing towards him. So he has definitely got something. He's selling something that people are buying.
Yeah.
And I watched Rishi Sunak gave a speech on Friday night after it and say he was very worried about what had happened. And he said, well, you know, you didn't put up a candidate that they liked better, for a start, Rishi Sunak. And then, and what's your answer to it?
Hmm.
And there wasn't really a kind of part two to that Rishi Sunak speech beyond, you know, you've let yourself down, you've let the whole school down.
Yeah.
And
it was
like,
really an attack on the voters, wasn't it? Saying
bold.
You really should have done better. And you know, I'm with my long, long knowledge of George, I would say they didn't vote well. They really didn't. But I'm not Prime Minister. I'm not making a full-blown attack on people who should be voting for him. But at no point did he say, I'm not scared. This is the reason why we should have a better candidate.
But I also think he offered a Gaza protest vote. And there are a huge number of people who want to, as you see from the marches in London every weekend, pretty much, there are a huge number of people for whom that is a very huge and energising issue. And he was the candidate that was the vessel for that. So I think...
But he is, I'm sure, on record as saying that he's not in favour of a two-state solution. So, I mean, a lot of the people who are pro-Gaza wouldn't necessarily want that to be the protest vote.
If you want a protest vote, the Lib Dems were right there, people. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, that's the politics I grew up with in the Iraq War. If you're upset about the Iraq War, the Lib Dems were right there.
I just thought Friday night was another example of how incredibly bad at politics our Prime Minister is. I've just thought of all the things. I mean, if any advisor surely would say to themselves, what George Galloway really, really wants now, what would absolutely make his day is if the Prime Minister personally comes out and names him and says, this is a terrible, terrible thing. So what does Richie do? Oh, it's awful that George Galloway... I mean, just playing entirely into his hands, isn't it?
Yep.
And then to give a speech about, you know, the forces of division and people playing culture wars. In the week after you've had to sack Lee Anderson, but actually still can't bring yourself to say exactly what it was that he said was wrong. It's just... How can you be that bad at politics and be a politician, let alone prime minister?
And the cartoonists are incredibly grateful. Literally all of them the next day did a picture of Rishi saying, well, the forces of extremism are terrible. And then they just put Suella Braverman and Lee Anderson in the picture. And they all did it. And everyone's thinking, you're making this too easy, Rishi. We've got to try harder.
That is your number one job as Prime Minister. Never make cartoonists happy.
No, don't.
You're failing if you're doing that. We're going to move on now to a subject that everybody on the internet has been talking about. Adam, tell me about Kate Middleton.
I can't quite work out why, because there's nothing new in there, is it? We found out in January that she'd been in hospital for a surgical procedure. We weren't told exactly what, and we were told that she was going to be out of action and not appearing in public until at least Easter. And then suddenly everyone sort of forgot about this a few weeks later and got all excited about it again last week and said, where is Kate? What's going on? Has she been kidnapped? And all this kind of thing. It was very odd.
It was particularly strange. I watched the BBC 6 o'clock news and they had the Raw correspondent on to be interviewed by the anchor to say, we actually don't know anything. And I thought that's really, it's interesting, isn't it, that now a kind of something reaches such a fever pitch of speculation online that you kind of have to pop up and say, it's not a mad conspiracy. We're not keeping anything from you. We just don't have anything to tell you. Sorry about that.
But it also coincided with another very, very sad story, which was a news story, which was the death of Thomas Kingston, the son-in-law of Prince Michael and Princess Michael of Kent. And that also just threw a really interesting light on the whole kind of idea of the royals and privacy and how much kind of privacy they are entitled to and how much privacy everyone is entitled to. Because I was copied in last week on a very cross email from the royal spin doctor, Tobin Andre, who was coming down quite hard on any newspapers and websites who reported details of where Thomas Kingston's body was found at, as has now been confirmed, his parents' house in Gloucestershire, accusing various websites, including the one he used to work for, the Daily Mail website, of gross intrusion of privacy and bad taste over details of where he was found and details of his parents' house in Gloucestershire. All of which then was confirmed and came out at the initial coroner's hearing of the inquest last Friday, which we also learned that which details that hadn't been reported in the paper, which is that he was found with a head wound, which was the cause of death, and a gun near the body. So and no suspicious circumstances, according to the police. So it was this slightly bizarre procedure of trying to keep a lid on details that were going to become public in a few days anyway. When Kate was in hospital back in January, there was, I don't think, any sort of formal kind of order or anything, but there was a request from the Royal Spin Doctors that the press pack should kind of not hang out outside the hospital and, you know, you shouldn't have what actually is a very, very traditional British tradition of, you know, Kay Burley on the pavement talking to someone in a Union Jack bowler hat saying, God bless them, get well soon, mom. You know, that's absolutely been a part of all royal coverage of any health issues.
And everything. Isn't it?
I'm pretty sure it's Magna Carta, isn't it? But it was really, really noticeable. And I've heard this was down to some slightly clever sleight of hand with the press pack when she actually left the hospital, that it was ensured that there were no photos could be taken of her, and certainly no photos appeared. And that, if you remember, I mean, Prince Philip was not afforded this this politeness when he was coming out of hospital shortly before his death. And indeed, in that same month, King Charles, after having his prostate procedure, you know, came out, waved to the crowds, did all of that kind of thing. So there does seem to be this requesting a level of privacy beyond what would be legally required or expected of most people. And also for a family who, the expectations of privacy are surely different for the royals as well. And you can see a lot of newspaper columnists kind of nudging their way towards this, kind of saying, well, you know, it really isn't sustainable to not say exactly what type of cancer King Charles has and exactly what's wrong with Kate. So no one's quite ready to kind of like break it. I don't think anyone actually knows. I mean, I certainly haven't heard. And, as journalists, we kind of hear rumblings around the place. But I don't think anyone actually knows what they are. But there's a sort of push.
Can we make this
it.
Clear then, Adam? I mean, it's not alien abduction. which seemed to be, I mean, amongst my group of friends, is top at the moment. So it's not that. The reason you can't even see a photo of her, because she's not on Earth.
Does she think she's off on planet Venus?
I mean, this is quite a strong runner out there.
I enjoyed the suggestion that she was off on a secret ambassadorial mission.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I'm not sure where in the world she's trouble-solving, but she's going to fix world peace, and then she'll be back after Easter.
My favourite was actually that she was that Oompa Loompa at the Glasgow Willy Wonka experience. But unfortunately, the actress who was in that wonderful photo that went viral of that has come out and said she's not Kate Middleton now. So I think we can rule that one out, at least.
I think it's a strange thing, though, because I'm sure everybody throughout British history has always gossiped about the royal health. It's just you couldn't really see that everybody was talking about it, right? You would just have done it in privately in the pub, and you never able to see that in every other pub everyone was also doing it. And that's what's kind of changed, is it's leaked out into Reddit forums and Twitter and wherever it might be.
In the pub, it would be recognised that the bloke who's behind the bar on the left telling you exactly what's wrong with Kate may not be very well sourced, and he may not know.
Probably not a royal insider, is it?
Probably not, no. And the fact that he knows someone whose mother used to know someone who's... That wouldn't be taken as definitive. Now, because of social media, everybody on the internet is incredibly sure. Mm. So the thing that always amazes me is the levels of certainty. No one says, I wonder if it's this. It says, it is this.
It's the way that journalism works now, isn't it? In that it's not journalists jumping on this stuff. It's SEO specialists, search engine optimization people, who are saying, wow, there's a lot of chatter about Kate's health. We need 5 articles about this within the next 5 minutes. And that sort of stuff is rattled out.
Talking about people who are well-sourced, in the last issue of the magazine, Flunky, our royal correspondent, had a piece about the new slimmed-down monarchy. Mm. And it seems to me there's been quite a lot of discussion, Adam, about the fact that that may have slightly backfired, with Charles out of action, Kate out of action, William taking some breaks to look after Kate, and Camilla, who doesn't seem to be the most enthusiastic royal in the world, although she turns up to things now, kind of left to shoulder a lot of the burden.
Yes, Camilla, I think Flunky's made quite clear before, Camilla was under the impression that she was going to get to her 70s and have a bit of a rest. go back to her house in Gloucestershire, the one that's just down the road from Prince Charles, the one she retires to whenever he's getting a bit too annoying for her. She leaves him to talk to the plants and goes back to her own house and smokes a fag, which is frankly what I think Camilla wants to spend her time doing. But no, she has stepped up to the plate. She's doing the stuff. The point that Flunky made in the last article he did for us, actually, interestingly, was that although there's been a lot of royal spin about Prince William stepping up to the plate and filling in for his dad, he hasn't actually done a great deal of that. Oh, no, absolutely fair enough. He's got, you know, his wife is ill. There is a lot going on. But
in terms of another planet.
Okay, we're pushing this one. Oh, you heard it here first, listeners. And he's got to do like the school run and, you know, take the kids to see her. And that's, you know, that's several light years every time, isn't it?
So. But I did see a welcome return for everyone's favourite royals, Prince Andrew and Fergie.
Pushing their way right to the front at the memorial service. Was it?
King Constantine of Greece.
Sorry, can we...
No. King Constantine of the Hellen.
Hellen, yes.
He's not King of Greece.
Can I just, even more importantly, put an X? King Greece does not. Greece and the Hellen, neither of them actually have a monarchy anymore, do they? He's not a king.
Well, explain that to the new King Pavlov.
The problem with the slimmed down royal family, and they are in real trouble. I mean, one of the working royals that they're reliant on is currently Princess Alexandra, the Honourable Lady Ogilvy. I love that title because it sort of suggests that she's got this evil twin called the Dishonourable Honourable Lady Ogilvy, who just goes around being really, really naughty. But now Princess Alexandra is a working royal, but I mean, she's 87 and she attended the memorial service in a wheelchair. She's in the official photos of the coronation, she was, bless her, having to be held up by I think Edward and Sophie on either side of her. I mean, this is not your kind of crack team of working royals to start with. So they have got a real problem. One solution I would like to propose for this is let's just give them a few weeks off. See if we can get by without them. I mean, if a few garden centres didn't get opened...
They're going to open themselves, are they, Adam? What are you proposing? Well, Scout huts are just...
There's these amazing things called door handles. You don't actually need a royal to go through it first.
Wow, on that scandalous note, I'm going to move on, Adam, and I'm going to leave you to think about how disrespectful and unpatriotic you've just been. Jane, we're going to move on now to a subject that is very dear to all of our hearts, which is West Midlands housing news. That's how I think of this. Which is the Crooked House pub.
Mm.
For anybody who hasn't listened to the previous episodes where we discussed one of my favourite Crooked House pubs, the Crooked House pub, what was it?
Well, obviously it was a pub. It had, in the 18th century, started out as a not crooked building, but underneath it's old mine workings, and as they've collapsed, the building had subsided, and then it had had sort of structures built on to keep it going despite being a sort of leaning tower of pub. And it was well loved as a local quirk, the pub that's leaning very far over. You could go in and play silly games with marbles and things, because the whole thing created a bit of an optical illusion and your pint would be all wonky.
Oh, like a pool table where it all just run to the end of the table.
Absolutely. So it was a sort of a well-loved local...
You sound as though you've been there.
Well, I'm not sure.
That's not a very good answer.
Might have just been a really, really drunk night in another pub in Dudley, and everything seemed to be at a funny angle.
Exactly.
So I was right than you know, Adam.
A local paper reporter in the West Midlands, and certainly on one occasion, the local reporters, went on an outing known as the Beer Bus. And for many years, I've thought that the Crooked House was one of the pubs the Beer Bus visited. And I went to that pub before it was tragically, illegally demolished. And then the other day I was thinking, did we, or was it just by the end of the evening, everything seemed on the wonk? So I'm not sure.
I wish I hadn't started this.
I want to know why we don't have a beer bus now. Come on.
Why I wish I hadn't started.
Champagne charabanc we could have, couldn't we?
Love it. Prosecco pedicab. Not if Chris Bryant has his way. Jane, but what happened? So the pub, as you say, was illegally demolished. What happened then?
Well, it went on fire first. When it went on fire, it was being considered for listing. It had been sold and closed as a pub. And locals were rather upset about this because it was a local quirk and everybody kind of thought of it as an important community thing and had memories of it. And while it was still under consideration, it went on fire, which remains under investigation. But what happened afterwards was the owners very rapidly demolished it without getting permission from the council for demolition. Now, their excuse for this was that it was not safe.
They weren't still selling pints in it at that point, presumably.
No. It was burned out, but you know, there's a lot you can do with a burned out brick building to put it right, but not once it's been demolished, or so it seemed.
And would I be too cynical to suggest that perhaps there was thoughts that this ex site of the pub could perhaps become, say, some quite lucrative housing or some sort of development?
Probably not, owing to the mine workings underneath, and the high risk of subsidence.
Right,
but
okay.
There's a landfill business which is adjacent, and in terms of what you could have done with the former site of the pub, it was a sort of expansion of that business rather than building some beautiful flats and selling them for a lot of money.
Build some big holes.
You could
be underneath the pub.
You could easily build some big holes because, well, there's obviously they're there.
But the brilliant and exciting news is that they've been ordered, haven't they, to rebuild the pub, and better even than that, to rebuild it crooked.
Yes, that's right. The company that owned the land that the pub is on has been ordered by South Staffordshire Council to rebuild.
My question is that possible and is it likely to happen?
It's theoretically possible. There was another old building that was also had a spectacular lean to it, which has been rescued and moved to the Black Country Museum. So it was possible there to sort of take it apart carefully and move it to another site. So it's not impossible to rebuild the building.
Is it desirable?
Well, the question really, if you do it, is have you rebuilt it or have you built a sort of funhouse model of it? The question of whether it's likely to happen, there's a few precedents. In 2021, in the Nooks column, I wrote about a pub, actually listed pub, in Ribble Valley in Lancashire called the Punch Bowl, which was demolished by its owners. And they're under an order to rebuild it. There's not a brick of it gone back up yet. And the 3-year time limit has now been reached on when they should have rebuilt it by. That said, the Carlton Tavern in London, though they were reordered to rebuild, and although it took 6 years in the end, that is now back open and serving customers. So
there's a glimmer of hope.
They were very big developers who had to rebuild the Carlton Tavern. So much more difficult to
hold them to account, I guess, if it's a husband and wife business essentially.
Yeah, much
it?
More difficult to for a big company to step away from a single plot of land and just say, well, screw you.
Well, this is, I guess, the fortnightly reminder of people to read the Nooks and Corners column, because you've been chronicling not just buildings that go on fire, but the new one that you were talked about, the Market Tavern in Sheffield, and the new one is that they collapse, but extremely neatly, suspiciously neatly.
Well, what's interesting in this case is obviously in the case of the Crooked House and South Staffordshire Council, councils ordered it rebuilt. The Punch Bowl and Ribble Valley, the councils ordered it to be rebuilt. The Market Tavern in Sheffield, which campaigners locally thought had been saved on the brink of destruction, they'd been told there's a stay on the demolition, and then mysteriously the next day they were told, terribly sad, it spontaneously fell down.
Could happen to anyone.
Well, unfortunately, somebody was videoing it, and it fell down largely because it was being knocked down by some demolition people, which the council later fessed up that they hadn't, in fact, cancelled the demolition. Unlike South Staffs and Ribble Valley, Sheffield Council was responsible for that building being knocked down. So I'm not sure who they order to rebuild it now.
But they order themselves? Or does Michael Gove have to step in and rebuild it?
Michael Gove personally?
Yes.
With a little trowel and some mortar.
He might have a lot more time on his hands in future, so that may not be entirely impossible.
I do find it quite pleasing that in the case of the Crooked House, now those people who knocked it down have to not only have to rebuild it, but they have to rebuild it crooked, which presumably is quite difficult, isn't it? But it's a lot more difficult to build a crooked house than it is just to let one kind of subside and go crooked. And, as you say, on these mine workings that are going to be really, really difficult to build on as well, aren't they?
Absolutely. I'm sure if you were to start from scratch and go, we'd like to build a lovely new pub here, it would be, I'm not sure that's advisable.
Can they not build it out of rack, your reinforced concrete, from previous podcasts? And in about 10 years' time, it will collapse anyway.
Nice lightweight material.
Exactly. A lot to recommend it, and quite guaranteed to collapse within a certain amount of time.
There is presumably no guarantee that it will reopen as a pub. I mean, it had closed as a pub because it wasn't financially viable in the first place, wasn't it?
It was put up for sale as a going concern and bought by the owners of the neighbouring scrapyard.
Okay, so it might... It could run as a pub again. That would be the best solution, presumably.
Possible that it was a going concern if somebody had been willing to fight for it. That said, an awful lot of pubs became not going concerns through 2021 because it was a very hard time for pubs. So,
Can I suggest that when and if it finally does get rebuilt, it's the first stop on the private eye beer bus then?
You're not going to let this drop, are you?
I'm pushing for it.
That's comfortably 2.5 hours away. This is going to be... I mean, that first 2.5 hours of conversation before we even like one pint is going to be dry. Isn't it? Come on, really.
Yeah, it's going to be a bitter lemon bicycle for you.
Good God.
The Nooks pub crawl is probably worth putting together. There are a lot of endangered pubs we've written about over the last year or so that people ought to go to.
I hope you're going to put one or two good news pubs in the itinerary, otherwise it's a very bleak tour. This one went...
Just sort of small piles of bricks, smouldering ruins.
This one fell down. No, I want a success story in the end.
Talking of something else that is so groaningly full it's close to collapse, see what I did there, the Private Eye podcast inbox is still open for business. Hopefully you enjoyed our last episode where we did a special post bag. If you want to email us, we are on podcast@private-eye.co.uk. And I've got one to read from you, some feedback from last time. This is from Tom in Winchester. Good afternoon. Enjoyed the latest pod, but it got me thinking about what food stuff is most like Private Eye. I hope you remember this from last time, Adam. I'd say a sausage. I don't really know what goes into it or how it's made. I feel simultaneously great and awful when I eat one, and I'm not sure if it's good for me or not.
Right. So. Awful, then, basically. That's what we're saying. Awful in a skin.
Yes, exactly.
Welcome to page 94.
The emulsified high-fat offal tube, I think, as they said in Yes, Minister. Anyway, that's. I thought we'd close on that. You can still send us more thoughts about what food stuff you think we are. Send questions for the team, which we'll address in a future episode. And as ever, of course, you can subscribe by going to either subsonline.co.uk or the Private Eye website at private-eye.co.uk. But for now, I'm going to say goodbye and thank you to Jane, Ian and Adam. And from me, Helen, goodbye.